You've got questions, and our guest chemical engineer has answers here on the K-12 Engineering Education Podcast. I'm Pius Wong. Several weeks ago, I put out a call for questions that you would ask to a chemical engineer. And today, we're going to get some of those questions answered. I got to talk with Will Mullen, a chemical engineer educated at North Carolina State University and now working as a process engineer and manager at a specialty chemical plant in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's also done a lot of K-12 outreach with kids ever since his college days throughout his stints at chemical plants in Texas and Georgia and up to now. Will joined the show to clear up listeners' perceptions about chemical engineering.
Yeah, so my name is Will Mullen. I am a chemical engineer working in or near Charlotte, North Carolina right now. I work for a small specialty chemicals company, so we're not doing the big oil refining or the huge continuous production of one or two different chemicals. We make a lot of different chemicals. And my job there is as a process manager, so I'm responsible for all operations of one of our processes, and then general engineering across the plant too. So whenever different areas run into concerns or issues that need to be elevated, usually above the maintenance level or something that needs to be looked at long term, they call me in to help out and see what we can do to provide some engineering fixes.
Thanks for spending some time with us, Will. I think that you've said a bunch of things that may or may not be familiar to teachers, students, or even other engineers listening. So first of all, you said you work at a specialty chemicals company. I'm curious mm-hmm. what that means.
So a lot of the larger chemical plants you can think of, like the oil refineries, things like that, they churn out a lot of gasolines and diesels and just massive amounts of specific chemicals, and usually not too many of those kinds of chemicals. Mm-hmm. And they're produced in continuous processes. So when those processes are running, you start them and you just run it for basically as long as you can until the equipment needs changed out, you need to add new materials to start back up, or until maintenance needs done. Whereas in specialty chemical plants, usually the way we work is we do it batch. It's like baking a cake. So you take all the different ingredients you need, you put them in the reactors at the right time, you do the reaction, and you stop it, and you take your chemicals out. A lot of the case where you have to do batch reactions is when the chemicals are either they don't have a huge market demand, or they're very difficult to make, or things like that, where it doesn't necessarily lend itself to just producing it 24/7 for weeks on end.
So it's basically the scale.
Mm-hmm. Scales is one major factor between continuous versus batch.
I see. What would be an example that people might be familiar with?
One of the ones, actually, I made at a previous facility I worked at, which was also specialty chemical. I know everybody's familiar with orange soda.
Yeah.
Say any brands, but orange soda. Orange soda uses water, and it uses an oil-type substance that actually provides that orange flavor, the citrus flavor. And you think about it, oil and water, they don't mix. And so you need some sort of emulsifier to actually get those two when they're put in solution to stay mixed after it is produced. You don't want to be walking down the grocery store aisle and see that you have a bunch of cans of soda with a layer of water and a layer of oil. You want this nice solid orange all the way through. And so one of the chemicals that was made at my last facility, we took a version of pine tree sap actually, and you just did the right types of changes to the molecular structure on it. And from there, it basically made an emulsifier that is used in orange soda.
Hmm. And you also talked about being a process engineer.
Mm-hmm.
What does a process engineer do, and how is that unique from other types of chemical engineers?
So there are a lot of different kinds of chemical engineers or different paths we can walk, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
A process engineer, we look at, it can be continuous. It can be batch processes. It can be quite a few different other things too. But ultimately, we are looking at things that are already built, and we're saying, okay, here's the system as it runs now. Let's take some data on it. Let's look at different ways of manipulating that data to understand, is there ways we could run this process more efficiently? Ultimately, I feel like most of engineering is trying to figure out how to do things more efficiently or do things in a way that's better for humans. And that's all we're doing in process engineering, is we're looking at something and saying, how can I make this process run so that we use the same amount of input materials, but we get more out? Or we take less energy to produce the same amount of material. or we use less raw materials. It's trying to make existing processes function better.
That's interesting that you specified some of those things. I think coming from my more product or mechanical engineering background, I might think about a certain set of design parameters like the size and weight of something or how much it costs. What are some of those key design parameters that you look for when you're designing a chemical or designing a process?
Well, that is one of the things I'm working on right now is the company I'm with. We are designing a new process. And one of the aspects about how my company works is we make molecules, chemicals that other companies have already designed. So the other company knows I want this specific molecule made and here's generally how to do it. And when it comes to my company, we say, all right, we understand we need to build this. What is the best way to design this such that we can produce it safely for our people? That's a major aspect. There's not much point in making something if you're going to hurt people by making it. Two, what is a way we can make it that is most environmentally friendly? Most of the time, it's not really too much of an issue. You can design things in such a way that there is not environmental consequences in any way. For some chemicals, obviously, though, there are environmental consequences, and you need to understand how to basically make those as minimal as possible or completely make them go away. And then once you get past the safety, you get past the environmental, and saying, what is the best way we can produce the most of this in the shortest period of time? In some cases, that takes it to batch. You want to produce it, you know, on a batch scale just because of whatever demands there are in the process. Other times it's continuous. You say, this is something we can continuously run safely and keep it in control, and we'll go with that.
You mentioned a lot of different things that I feel like students today, they might actually learn about some of these topics, but what are some of the things you think young people should know about the field of chemical engineering that maybe they just don't know right now?
One of the biggest things I think about when I think about chemical engineering, just in a general day-to-day sense, is that like everything around us, every single piece of material, equipment, anything that's around you, even in just regular day-to-day life, was designed in some sort of way. You take a plastic straw. Generally, those are made of polypropylene. Somebody had to figure out how to make that polypropylene and make it into the right shape. Obviously, making it the right shape and things like that is more on the consumer side. It's not necessarily on my side, but the polypropylene itself had to be produced. So a lot of chemical engineering is trying to figure out the ways to make these chemicals that are needed on large scales and make them safely. I think it's just interesting how many things are touched by chemical engineering. And I'm sure plenty of other engineers you've had on the show have said the same thing about their engineering degrees, but it really is. Engineering touches everything. Right. And when you go back to talking with younger students about this, I've talked to other students, younger students, about engineering in general, mostly. Having a creative mind, I feel like, is one of the most important assets you can have if you want to be a good engineer. Obviously, you need to be able to, you know, think in a certain kind of way a lot of the time. You need to have at least some desire to do math and science and things like that. But being able to look at a problem, doesn't matter what the problem is, chemical engineering, electrical, aerospace, materials, any of that, and try and look at it in a little different lens maybe than other people have been looking at it, or a completely different lens than anyone has ever looked at it before, and say, would this potential other method work to solve this problem? And if you don't have that creativity, it makes it very hard to come and bring all these ideas that are outside the box that could solve a problem in a new way. I mean, ultimately, we need to solve problems. There's thousands, hundreds of thousands of problems out there every day that people encounter. And if you can't find a creative way to come up with a solution, you're not going to get very far in solving that problem. So being a creative engineer that'll get you very, very far in the engineering world.
How can people get that creativity? Do you believe that that's something that some people say you have it or you don't? Or do you believe that's something you can learn, that young people can learn how to think outside the box, so to speak, or get that creative mind that you're talking about?
I think creativity is really a skill like anything else. It's something that if you try and develop and you do things that make you have to think differently. And even if just going all the way down to like elementary school here, just play, having fun and enjoying what you're doing and playing with friends, it causes you to think. And you think and deal with people and you run into problems, you just social problems it may be, you're playing war with your friends or something like that. It causes you to think differently. And as you get older, you start getting presented with a little bit more challenging problems. And some of those problems may be at school, some of them may be at home, some of them may be in any of the sports you play. But thinking about how to solve those problems and ways that are unique and ways that are different, that's going to start building that creative mind. I think everybody starts off with the ability to be creative. And when we get so narrowed in or so channeled into single ways of thinking or doing things the same way every single time, it weakens that creativity muscle. And you want to get it back, you just have to work at it more. Mm-hmm. I know one of my outlets, one of my hobbies I do is photography. I really love just getting out and walking around with my camera, especially I live in Charlotte, like I said earlier, mm-hmm. And walking around the city and finding different ways to take pictures of things or taking pictures of my friends and people I know. There's so many different ways you can portray a message in a picture just by looking at someone's body language. And for me, that is creativity, understanding how those different things work. And it's one, it pulls me away from a lot of the highly, highly technical aspects of my work. And two, it really works those creative muscles.
So you really do think that even for photography, those skills are similar in terms of viewing a problem or viewing a subject in different ways?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The biggest, I wouldn't even call it much of a difference is I know that I'm nowhere near an amazing photographer at all. I'm probably just a decent photographer, but there's people that develop their skill in photography to a level that they can look at a problem being how to properly photograph some food for a food ad or how to photograph a model or maybe someone who would like model photos taken, but is just really uncomfortable in front of a camera. And those really talented photographers know how to basically work with that person and make them feel comfortable and get these pictures that draw out from them this amazing personality. And that's the kind of thing you want to represent on an image from that person. The same thing happens with engineering, just on a different way. You're developing a different technical skill such that you can take energy, take matter, and make it perform to the best way that we can use it as humans.
Sometimes engineering might get a bad rap. It might be stereotyped, kind of like how you were talking about what people might think of when they envision a chemical engineer or any other mm-hmm. type of engineer. First of all, are any of those stereotypes accurate? I'm not going to list some of them out, but are you aware of how people view engineering? And I'm curious, like, what kind of myths would you want to bust about engineering?
Well, I'm definitely aware of the stereotypes about engineering. Thinking back, so I went to chemical engineering at NC State.
North Carolina State.
And yeah. North Carolina State, yeah. And I can't say exactly, but I felt like within the chemical engineering department, there was probably my year close to 50-50% male-female. Obviously, the stereotype is that engineering is mostly male. I did not feel at any point that it was weird having the females in the class. I mean, they were just as talented as anybody else in there, if not more so than many of the guys. I don't think that the stereotype that males are better at engineering than females has any credence whatsoever. I think anybody that really has a drive, one is creative, has a drive to fight through that challenging aspect of going through engineering school and wants to make a difference in the world through engineering has the ability to. It doesn't matter what your background, race, sex, any of that is. Some of the other engineerings did have within at NC State did have a little bit more skew towards male-female. So I did see that, and that lent itself to those typical stereotypes. But after getting in the working world, I did see a lot that a lot of my friends who were female chemical engineers did have a little bit tougher time. And you have to understand, too, that when I started in chemical engineering, I went into the industrial manufacturing, oil refinery type world down in Houston. And that has a little bit of a reputation on the operations side out with the guys who are running the field of being dirty, kind of a male dominated world.
Sure.
Some of the girls that I was very close friends with, still am close friends with, they just met it face on. They said, hey, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to be confident because I know I'm skilled. And they're still doing very, very well. But I know they've told me that there is a little bit of a more of a barrier of proving themselves that they have to overcome. And I really think that's a shame because, again, just because of someone's background or sex, there's no reason to think that they are any less talented than anybody else when it comes to any skill. It just matters what you put in to learn it.
Hmm. Is it true that the oil fields or the oil industry, that's really where a lot of chemical engineers make a lot of money or find a lot of success? Like, is that the hot industry in chemical engineering?
From my perspective, again, I was in it for a while. That kind of biases me as far as what I saw. A lot of people did make a lot of money in there and a lot of chemical engineers went into it. But there's so many different things that chemies can go into. I've got a lot of people who work in the opposite side of the oil. They work in green energies and technologies and things like that, working with power grids actually to make sure the power grids are functioning in the best way that they can, or work with renewable energies like solar and wind. Then there's the specialty chemical side away from the refineries, like I'm in now. There's some that work in sports cars. I've got quite a few friends actually who went to go work in industries producing sports cars and regular vehicles. There's food. A large portion of chemical engineers will go into the beverage or food manufacturing. And obviously there's some perks to that one, especially if you work in the brewery side of things.
Yeah, there's a chemical engineer locally here in Austin who created their own brewery, but there's a whole bunch of custom beers here.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like basically, unlike the stereotype, chemical engineers work in all sorts of fields. How did you know what you wanted to work in, or what advice would you have for young people who maybe they are interested in chemical engineering, but they aren't sure what part of it to try?
I struggled a lot, especially near the end of college, with what exactly I wanted to do. Obviously, there's a stereotype. I feel like I've used that word a lot here today. There's a stereotype that chemicals are bad. Yeah, anytime you use the word chemical, it means that it's something dangerous or negative. So taking that, in addition to the fact that I also, one of my passions is leadership and teamwork and developing teams to do tasks. I was trying to figure out in my head how to make those two come together, because I knew I was on track with chemical engineering to go into some sort of chemical sector, but I also wanted to be working with people a lot. Maybe that's a potential other stereotype, that engineers aren't the most social, and there are plenty of engineers that are not social, and that's just what they are. And there's nothing wrong with that either, but that's not me. I am pretty extroverted. I like being around people. I take energy from being around people. And I was always concerned that I would kind of end up in this world of places and jobs where I was not able to work with people a lot and do things that really made a difference to a lot of people. A lot of chemical engineering jobs are not directly consumer facing. They are behind the scenes making chemicals that go into products that go to customers or things like that.
Yeah.
So I had some concerns there, but I went into it and I kept driving forward, and I ended up finding a program with my first company that was a leadership development program. So the goal there was, they start us off with the company as an engineer, but once a month for about a week, every single one of those months for a year, you would actually be flown out to a different location with the company that they had a different thing they produced there, or a technology center, or some sort of regional office, and you'd learn a different aspect of the company. And the goal was to just take these fresh engineers out of college and help them kind of round themselves out. Instead of going and sitting in one chemical plant doing chemical engineering or process engineering there, you learned about the broad aspects of the company, so that in the future, hopefully, you could provide a more balanced perspective as a manager. You can go into roles that are a little higher up. And ultimately, I am especially with my new company, I started as a process engineer and I've moved into engineering and management. And I would like to continue going that direction. Still, I have every once in a while that feel that I am somewhat isolated from doing the people interactions that I like, but I get that via working with K-12 through things like this. And a couple of times I've actually gone and done science demonstration days for elementary, middle, or high schools.
That's awesome.
I'm actually working right now on hopefully being able to bring some of the NC State chemical engineering students down to where I work to do a chemical engineering spend a day so that they can learn, here's what engineering and chemical engineering specifically looks like in the real world. Those kind of things that they aren't necessarily my day-to-day job, they give me the ability to work with people in a way that I love. So I've found ways to work that in.
So there is space for all types of engineers, personality-wise and with different backgrounds. Okay. You know, you said a bunch of things that definitely relate to other questions that people sent me to ask you. So I want to get ready for that. Before we go straight into the questions, I did want to ask a little bit more about your background at NC State. I mean, it is really cool that I think it's really cool that you go and do that outreach and connect your profession with, you know, K-12 education. How can engineers get involved in that? Or I guess there's two questions. How can professional engineers get involved in education? And then how do you think educators can come in contact with real working engineers?
Well, starting from the engineers side, I feel like every time I've reached out to schools or programs that work with schools saying like, I'm a chemical engineer and I'm willing to volunteer my time to work with students and talk with them and kind of get them excited about chemical engineering or science or whatever it may be, mostly just science, because obviously at the lower grade levels, that's really what the main focus is.
Sure.
Every time I've reached out, there's been excitement. Teachers have said, yes, please, you know, we don't get this very often. This is something we want. And maybe that's just a product of the location I'm in now or the location I've been previously. But I feel like there's enough demand out there that if someone does have an interest as an engineer in doing that, they just need to reach out to their kids' school, some of the schools of some of their friends' kids, or just researching online, finding something. I know one of the ones that you recommended to me actually was Skype a Scientist, that program, reaching out to schools that way. There's programs out there, and doesn't take too much effort, I feel, as an engineer to find programs like that.
So an engineer has to not be afraid to make that first move.
Which is always tough. I mean, I know, again, not too many engineers are socially extroverted, but you reach out, there's demand out there. From the teacher's side, though, it's a little bit different. One of the ways that I got involved pretty soon after I started out here, we are designing a new chemical process at my facility. And part of designing a new chemical process, you obviously have to have the ability to control that. You have to have control valves and temperature readings and all the things that make sure that we safely produce a chemical. And the company that is doing our control valve design and control system design for us, one of the guys working there said, hey, my wife works for the school district down here. She knows I'm going to a chemical plant, and asked if I could see if anybody here would be interested. So it kind of came out of nowhere and hit me. This point here, I feel like applies across the board within engineering. It applies everywhere. Is one of the biggest things you can do just to succeed in life in general that I've seen so far is to network, is to get out and talk with people, because most of the time, the big jumps and the advances and connections you're going to make that move you forward come from people that you don't know very well. It's somebody you've met maybe a few times that you can say, oh, I remember that person does this. I wonder if they'd be willing to talk to me about it. And the larger your network is, the more people you know, the more people you can think of that have that. And hopefully they think of you whenever the situation may arise. So I guess creativity, now we've talked about, and networking are two huge things to moving forward and doing well in the chemical engineering and engineering world.
Will, you also talked about how you had experience even in college kind of working in education or doing some of this outreach to young people. Do you think teachers can reach out to their local colleges and try to find those types of organizations? Is it pretty common for colleges to have these engineering outreach programs?
I feel like it would be. Again, I'm very thankful that I got to go to NC State because they had such a good program like that. I was involved with the NC State Engineering Ambassadors. So the goal of that program, as I saw it, was to basically represent the College of Engineering at NC State to prospective students who may go there. And usually that meant us reaching out to high school students who were coming for tours of the campus or had heard about it, and they wanted to learn a little bit more about engineering at NC State. And the program, there was enough of us ambassadors in that program that were also tied in with the other aspects of the College of Engineering, one of which was the K-12 outreach, that the K-12 program would reach out to us and say, hey, you know, can we get some of you ambassadors to come help out with these events? Mm. And I got to say, when you've got, you know, hours of thermodynamics homework or transport homework and things like that, and you're stressed because you got a test, and you can just go out to one of these events and just work with little kids to help design a better boat out of foil that can hold the most marbles, or figure out the best way to arrange some tin foil such that it does not allow a piece of chocolate to melt that is above a light bulb. Just things like that, that is very stress relieving. Hmm. And that was very helpful for me going through college. But back to your question, I think that yes, reaching out to a local university, even if it is just a community college, there's going to be a chemistry or a pre-engineering type program there. And if they can't help you, they know somebody who can. And they would connect teachers with the right people, people that they know, either further education people or past students that would be willing to help out with that. And that's actually a great place to start.
Awesome. You already talked about this a little bit, but my co-host who can't make it today, she actually has a question for you. You kind of already started talking about it. She asks, she's thinking about how can teachers engage students to understand that natural, in quotes, isn't always good and chemical, in quotes, isn't always bad. She's wondering, she gives the example like why aluminum salts in vaccines aren't harmful, or how there's more mercury in an apple or in breast milk than in vaccines, or why colloidal silver should not be in a typical home medicine cabinet. She says, what types of safe experiments or demonstrations or resources do you know of, or can you maybe suggest to combat science illiteracy and fear? That's her exact phrase. So that's a very powerful question, I feel like, but
yeah, it's a very broad question.
Yeah. But I think, like, as you heard, her main concern is science illiteracy or engineering illiteracy in a way, especially with regards to chemicals that we use every day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think you have these same fears. How would either you get over it, or how would you help other young people get over some of these issues?
All right. So let's see where I can start with this.
Let's break it down. Yeah.
So one of the main things that I'm sure people have heard before is that it's not necessarily the specific chemical or material that is a problem. It's the dose. So extremely small amounts of things, there's certain metals that you need to have to survive. If we don't have those in our diets, we do not survive. Mm-hmm. But if you have too much of those, they will kill you. It's all about how much you're taking in the right ratios, and a little more on the chemical side here, the form of those. There's different oxidation states and things like that some are good and some are bad as it comes to affecting human health. Like I said, that is on the chemical side, and that is well above me, I know, but well above most people and their ability to understand and make rational decisions about. But there are people out there, doctors, research scientists, people whose entire careers have been built upon the fact that they want to understand if these things are good for humans. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that we should be turning to and listening to. Obviously, though, they make mistakes sometimes. Everyone makes mistakes. And it can be very regrettable when those mistakes do affect a large amount of people.
Right.
But we have systems in place. We have the scientific method. We have peer-reviewed journals and things like that that are out there to question the way things are done, question the methods of the studies, question the results of the studies to say, is this actually valid? Are the findings you put forth here, are they tested in enough ways that prove beyond as much of possible doubt that this chemical is safe for you? Did you test it on enough people? There's a lot of statistics involved that make sure that your sample sizes are big enough to capture all kinds of different people that have different backgrounds and things like that. I trust that system to most of the time be correct. If I ever have questions about things, and again, I'm very curious about things. I told you creativity and kind of tied to that curiosity are very important to be in engineering. I'm very curious about things. And if there's something out there, I'm going to Google it. I know a lot of people, when there's medicines that are prescribed or a lot of this vaccine issue that's going on right now, they Google it. They go out there and they try and find information. That Googling, that's good to gain an understanding short term just here and for myself, but that is nothing compared to someone who has spent their entire career working on it. And if I find a couple pages that may say one thing, one, I'm going to check to make sure what the backgrounds of those pages are and understand kind of where they're coming from and who's funding them. But ultimately, I'm going to test or trust the people that have spent their whole careers basically focused on doing this, because I've always felt that people in general want to do the right thing. And there's a lot of scientists and engineers out there and medical professionals who do want to do the right thing. And I'm going to trust them.
Do you think students should be already investigating or reading these scientific journals? I don't even know if they do that a lot in school, but like you're talking about Googling, and I do know that students Google, but I guess doing that extra step that you're talking about checking sources and where it's coming from. I mean, do you think students should be checking, I don't know, the Journal of Chemical Engineering or something?
That can be tough, obviously, because of the technical level of a lot of those journals. And a lot of that stuff is hidden behind paywalls, sadly. But I think the biggest thing to take away from that is to have a skeptical mind. Whenever you read something, you know, question what, why is this being presented this way? And don't solely rely on one specific thing. You need to understand that when you Google a question that you may have, Google's going to give you answers specific to that question. And if you ask the question a little different way, Google's going to give you very different answers potentially. So you can almost bias the answers you get just by how you ask the question. So skepticism towards what you're reading and skepticism towards how you're approaching it can really go a long way towards helping students understand when a lot of the time the journals and the actual material that says flat out, here's the way things are, can be way above their technical level.
Sounds like a good opportunity for collaboration amongst, say, science and engineering and English teachers, but we will see.
Yeah.
Another side question. So you're a chemical engineer. Why did you study chemical engineering as opposed to just straight up chemistry?
I started in engineering because I wanted to actually be a pilot, a military pilot.
Wow.
I found out that a lot of pilots do go through engineering school. And so that just seemed like a natural fit for me. I'd always very much enjoyed science. And especially in high school, I really fell in love with chemistry and just the challenge of it and the logic behind it and how crazy it was, the different things you could do. So when I got to college, I started in aerospace engineering. So that's going to focus more on the design of planes and different things that create lift or drag and things like that. I'm sure somebody else can explain it a lot better than I can. But as I started going through the course curriculum that freshman year, there was 18, I think, different engineering majors at NC State. Despite the fact that I chose aerospace, they want us to look at all the different engineerings because we've chosen one, we came in with one mindset, that may not be where we end up. A lot of engineers actually at NC State, and I'm sure other schools too, start in one thing and switch to another. And so in looking at some of these other majors out there, specifically chemical engineering in my intro to engineering class, I found that that appealed a little bit more towards me. I liked the fact that I could continue taking chemistry classes, which I know, again, is not too common.
I know, like I hated chemistry.
So I wanted to do more chemistry, and that was the main drive to push me towards chemical engineering. kind of versus that in chemistry, chemical engineering just sounded, one, like it paid more. And two, I don't really want to be someone who's in a lab a lot. And I'm sorry to any of the chemists out there that are not in labs a lot, but I wanted to do something that's just a little bit more out in the field and doing work that produces things on a larger scale. I feel like chemistry is more the development of different molecules specifically on small scale and figuring out how different things can be made molecules wise, whereas engineering takes what is done in chemistry, chemical engineering does, and starts figuring out how to produce those efficiently on a large scale.
Hmm. Regardless of what advice you're giving, students should try it and see how it goes, because that's kind of what you did as well.
Yeah, the biggest thing I felt like, I mean, if you feel like engineering is for you, and everyone should feel like that initially, you want to come in with an open mind. There's something called the Engineering Grand Challenges, which is something they focus on a lot at NC State as well. And that is, I believe it's 14, but it's a list of the challenges that are most critical to humanity going forward into the future.
Yeah.
And one of the things they taught about it at NC State is, yes, some of these may seem like, oh, that's a chemical engineering challenge that they focus on. But no, all the majors and all the disciplines of engineering kind of weave together to help solve these problems. And keeping an open mind and not one-tracking yourself into one specific type, especially when you first come in and you haven't really been exposed to it very much, allows you to think about those and think about the best way for you to fit into helping solve the problems that you want to solve.
Hmm. I have a question from a chemist, actually. Mm-hmm. Justin asks, and this may be very into the weeds here, but let me know. He asks, what is the difference between the economics of petroleum versus biological feedstocks for specialty chemicals? So that's one thing from him. I'm not actually sure what that means. So I'm wondering if you could translate part of that.
Well, I can take a guess at it.
Okay.
So a lot of the chemicals we use, I guess I can take plastics for now. A very common plastic out there is polypropylene. That's actually what I was talking about earlier mm-hmm. with straws. Mm-hmm. That is a polymer made from propylene. So propylene has a double bond in it, and it allows it to basically just take one molecule of propylene and react with a lot of other ones and make these huge long chains of polypropylene then, which is plastic. And most of the time that propylene is derived from crude oil mm-hmm. and the oil refining process. There are other ways to make those molecules. And some of those ways, I don't know about for propylene, but some of those molecules can be made biologically. Different types of algae and cells can create molecules that are useful to humans. One of my things I did in undergraduate research was actually took algae and made biodiesel from it. Hmm. We actually had the algal cells create biodiesel, which is pretty neat because we were then able to power a car with it.
Wow.
One of the biggest drawbacks to a lot of that right now is that the oil and refining industry, the petrochemical industry, is so entrenched and so built up that the equipment is there now to produce enough to meet the needs of the economies of the world very cost effectively. Whereas that infrastructure to do things on a biological way is not built up. And so it's much less cost effective to do things there because we just don't have the background or the infrastructure to do it yet.
Hmm.
That may be a stab at answering the question. Hopefully covers it enough for him.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Actually, this is kind of a two-parter, but he asked a question that's kind of related to that. He has more experience mm-hmm. in pharmaceuticals, and he was saying, or he's asking, do you use any enzyme reactions? Because that's getting more popular for pharmaceuticals. Do you use enzyme reactions for specialty chemical production? And if not, what's preventing that?
It can be used. I have not used it in any of mine. Mm-hmm. So I guess to explain that a little bit more to people who may be listening, chemical reactions, some of them occur. You put the two chemicals together and it forms chemical B or C. A plus B goes to C. You don't have to do anything but mix them. Other chemicals, when you put them together, they want to become C, but you need to provide a little bit of a bump to get them going. A lot of the times, the ways we'll do that is we use a catalyst. And those catalysts can be different types of specialty metals or things like that, or you heat it up. And that provides the extra energy that you need to get over that bump to cause the reaction to happen. enzymes can do that as well. So it's kind of like a biological way of getting around that extra energy you need. And it is used, I'm sure, in plenty of pharmaceutical methods. But as far as my background, I've not actually dealt with any before.
Okay. I have another question. What are the best products that can be truly recycled for reuse or truly positive, truly have a positive environmental impact? If you can answer that.
Yeah, that's a tough one too. Obviously, you have to think about it from one of the terms that we use is cradle to grave. So from the very initial creation of that chemical all the way to where it's disposed of at the end. Some chemicals take a lot of really nasty production methods at the beginning to produce them, but then they are able to be reused over and over and over and over again. And that can be a positive thing. Mm-hmm. Other chemicals, you use them over and over and over again, but at the end, they can have really nasty side effects, kind of like the nuclear byproducts. And while I don't have the best way to answer this question, it really takes a lot of looking at chemicals one by one and understanding, or any sort of material, and understanding what it takes to make it, how much use you can get out of it before then you have to recycle it. I know a lot of people like talking about plastics and things like that. You can reuse them a million times, a lot of them. But as we're seeing more and more nowadays, you have that plastic lasting for forever and staying around in the environment. So one of the things that people are looking at is changing a little bit the ways that those plastics are made, such that just via the sun, UV radiation, it can break those down when they do inevitably end up as trash somewhere. So you have to think about the whole cradle to grave aspects of these chemicals to understand where they really fit as far as beneficial chemicals go.
That's really fascinating. I think that coming from a different engineering field, I wouldn't necessarily think about how a product is broken down or how to control exactly when a product is destroyed. Like if I create software, I'm not going to design it to immediately blow up, you know, after 3 years.
Like that'd be a problem if you did that.
Well, I don't know. That could be like a weapon or something. But in any case, I guess from the chemical engineering perspective, is that one of the, I don't know if it's a grand challenge, according to the National Academy of Engineering, but is that like a growing industry drive to be able to control when chemicals disappear?
Oh, very much so. Because a lot of what we hear about now, and especially with people my generation and younger, there's this drive to not only go into the workplace to make money, but to also make a difference. And one of the biggest things on our radar right now, and everyone's should be radar, is how we're treating the world and finding different ways to produce things, because there are ways out there and we just may not have discovered the best ways yet. Finding those ways to produce, and one, produce the energy we need to sustain our quality of life, and then to produce the materials we need to sustain our quality of life in ways that are green and protect the planet and do not hurt future generations. That's huge. I don't specifically think if or remember if that is a grand challenge, but that is probably one of the most pressing things that we could think about right now. And there are ways to do it, but we need lots more chemical engineers and every other kind of engineer to help us understand what those problems are and how to best solve them.
Speaking of materials engineering, Cindy asks you, where do you see materials science going in the future? Are there any new developments that we should be excited about?
I think a lot of those, again, tie back to how we produce the materials we do that keep our quality of life where they're at. A lot of those materials are plastics right now, and a lot of them are coming from oil. The oil refiners, like they talked about with polypropylene earlier. A lot of those plastics end up being made ultimately from crude oil that we pull out of the ground. A lot of people have a lot of negative thoughts about that, and there are negative aspects to it. There's an environmental detriment to burning and using that crude oil, but there are other ways to make those. And especially from your material sciences, basically what that is looking at different materials out there and understanding how we can make them meet our needs. Do we need to make little tweaks to the molecules that make it function the way we need it to? I don't know right now of any specific things out there that are big or on the radar, but I know that at labs and companies and universities all across the world, there are people working on, you know, the next big thing. Mm-hmm. And sadly, a lot of those aren't going to make it. But it doesn't take very many really, really good ones to make a big change. And so if you get the right people working on things and they have the right kind of one science behind it and then backing, they can really make an impact if they push it forward. And I think, I'm sure every year there's going to be something coming out from some university or some company that is going to be helping take away our reliance on a lot of that crude oil and those fossil fuels.
I have another question from an engineer listener. Mm-hmm. I need to set this up a little bit, but he was basically talking about how in science fiction today and for the last, you know, decades, in science fiction, we always think about like robots and the cool like software developments, and we think that all of that is really awesome. I'm wondering, or he's wondering, is there any chemistry in science fiction that really is cool to you? Like the robots that we saw in Star Wars, maybe that inspired roboticists today, you know? Is there anything that, that you've seen in sci-fi in terms of chemistry, materials, chemical engineering that that makes you go, oh, we should totally do that. Why aren't we working on that?
One of the things, and I guess this, again, that, that question just asks for the nerdiness to come out. So I'm going to let it come out.
Yeah, let it come out.
A lot of things that you read about in science fiction novels or movies or things like that rely on traveling extremely long distances between stars or galaxies far, far away in very, very short periods of time. We don't have the ability to do that right now. We don't have the ability to reach light speed. We can speed up individual elements or atoms and things like that up to near the speed of light, but we can't actually get there. So a lot of these books, they talk about these different methods that can get them. Oh, they have an ion drive or different types of special physics that they take advantage of to get them to light speed or past light speed so they can make those travels. That's really cool because I'm sure there are technologies out there we don't know about, or technologies are still very, very young that we can use to travel these long distances, because at some point in the future, we're going to probably need to leave Earth to get to other habitable planets. It's probably going to take a while. And the faster we can get there via faster ships or special light speed drives, the better things are going to be. And I know one really cool thing that's out there right now is they call it the solar sails. So basically you put this spacecraft up into space and it deploys this massive tinfoil like sail basically out there. And when you think about a sailboat on the water here on Earth, you put the sail up and it catches the wind, and the wind pushes this, the boat forward because it hits that sail and the sail is attached to the boat. The boat goes forward. A similar concept actually applies on the solar level. So all those little electrons, even though they have almost no mass whatsoever, all those little electrons actually do have a tiny little bit of mass, and they push on this solar sail because this solar sail is huge. And over time, it just speeds it up more and more and more and more until it picks up a huge amount of speed. And we're actually using that on some of our spacecraft right now to travel really far out in the universe. And that's just one really cool aspect that I'm sure had some sort of science fiction background before that is all of a sudden real now. And how many other things out there got somebody inspired from reading in a book that in the future is going to be a real physical thing? I mean, I don't know, but it's going to be neat.
All right. Well, that's pretty cool. I think I had heard of that and I got to look up more into that. Mm-hmm. Will, what questions do you have about the field of chemical engineering that or not just you, but what questions have you heard of that is really fascinating to you that if you had a whole bunch of time on your hands and you didn't have to design certain specialty chemicals right now at your job, what kind of question would you investigate?
Probably the biggest ones would be related to energy. How can we, again, provide the energy we need to sustain our way of life? How can we bring people up to a quality of life that they deserve, that everyone deserves? And doing that in a way that is good for the environment, I think that would be just amazing to work on, to work on renewable energies. I think nuclear is very, very interesting. It obviously has some pretty major drawbacks, but overall, from what I've read, it is still probably one of the safest methods of energy production we have, but I'm sure there's other ones out there. I would love to work on things that help provide large scale amounts of energy to people everywhere in the world. I think that would just be amazing. My biggest thing is going to college. A lot of people have that fear about, oh, college is going to be tough, and especially engineering is going to be really tough. But having an open mind, being creative, and just getting involved and meeting people, that is how you're going to get ahead. It's the creativity, networking. You get ahead because of your own determination and the help of other people, I feel. Nobody gets anywhere all by themselves. And that is especially true for engineering school. It is hard. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but it means that you're probably going to need help along the way. And having your friends there to help you out and having that just drive to make it through and being creative, it's very much worth it at the end.
Well, thanks very much, Will. I'm glad that you're plugging college. I happen to agree with you. So I hope that we get a lot of inspired engineers after listening to you.
Oh, yeah, hopefully. I think that's the whole reason I came on here, is to hopefully make a difference for somebody out there who's interested.
That was Will Mullen, chemical engineer. If you're an educator who wants to reach out to Will, he shared a public email for you, and you can find it in this episode's show notes. For these notes and more, you can also visit the new podcast website, k12engineering.net. This show is made possible thanks to the generous individual donors on Patreon. I do this show in my extra time between teaching, coding, and organizing, and any bit you can contribute helps me so much. You can donate by just pledging at patreon.com/pioslabs. That's Pios with an O. And you can also support me by checking out my book, Engineer's Guide to Improv and Art Games. All this info is also at the website k12engineering.net. The K-12 Engineering Education Podcast is an independent production of Pios Labs in Austin, Texas. Thank you for listening. Post-show notes time. Hey, this is Pius once more. Just wanted to let you know that Rachel and I are officially planning a live podcast session at South by Southwest EDU in March 2020 here in Austin, Texas, and we are so excited. Now, Rachel would normally join me, but she's really busy managing stuff in a school district, so that's what she's doing, but she's going to be there moderating our live podcast panel. Our panel's all about asking, how do you develop a career in educational technology? I'm personally interested because, hey, that's what I do, basically. And Rachel's interested because she loves technology and she loves education. I think that if you are someone who wants to get into this industry of ed tech, then you should join or you should listen. Or if you can't do either, if you can't make it to South by Southwest, I want you to help us organize this live panel. One panelist is going to be Steve Dembo. That's our plan. He's from Teach 42, and he's got his own consulting company, and he helps school districts and schools use educational technology. Our second panelist is Chris Fancher from PBL Works. That was formerly the Buck Institute, but they were really huge on project-based learning. And Chris also consults on educational technology while also teaching. Victoria Thompson is our third panelist, and she is a young teacher and edtech consultant as well, who has experience with a whole host of different major technology companies and using their technologies in schools. She's actually replacing our original proposed panelist, Melanie Kong, which is unfortunate. Melanie Kong has some great news. She actually is doing stuff with her startup Floop, which I can't divulge completely, but she's doing stuff that conflicts with South by Southwest EDU. And so in her stead, we're going to have Victoria Thompson, who is also part of the Floop startup team. But Victoria also has her own unique perspectives on educational technology and how to get into the field and how to formalize the field. And I'm excited to have her as well. So this is kind of my unrehearsed excitement, just telling you about what we're doing at South By. We are officially on the program, and I am happy to tell you all that. Just stay tuned for more notes about that, and please do let Rachel and me know what questions should we ask these folks. Looking forward to seeing you all at South by Southwest EDU in Austin.